listening to His Time. I'm Andy Bates. It's time for the Daily Lectionary, underwritten by Lutheran Federal Credit Union. Our guest pastor joining us by phone today, Pastor Jacob Bobby from First Trinity Lutheran Church in Bloomfield, Nebraska. Pastor Bobby, welcome to His Time.
Thank you for having me.
Looks like we've got a great text ahead of us today, a lot to study. Looking forward to studying that with you today. Tell us about your congregation, First Trinity Lutheran Church in Bloomfield, Nebraska.
First Trinity is a kind of a small town congregation here in Bloomfield. Bloomfield is about 1,100 people, so a small Nebraskan town, and our congregation here is about 350 members, and friendly, lots of families, lots of children actually in our congregation. I think from birth to senior, we maybe have 78 kids, mostly on the 1 to 6 years old. Lots of young kids, so very friendly, a good congregation. Yeah.
Well, thanks be to God for this congregation in a small town and proclaiming the good news of Jesus there in Bloomfield, Nebraska. We are studying Luke chapter 23, verses 1 through 25 today. What would you like for us to know, Pastor, as we prepare to study?
Well, I won't go back too far in Luke, but throughout all of Luke, Jesus is opposed by the Jewish leadership, but this really begins to come to a head. Sort of with Jesus's triumphant entry in chapter 19. And so then after that, it's sort of the tension begins to build pretty right away. And so right after the triumphal entry, Jesus cleanses the temple, which I'm sure didn't make the Jewish leadership happy. And we are told that the chief priests and the principal men were even then seeking to destroy him. And so after that, in verse chapter 20, the chief priests and the scribes continue to challenge Jesus on his authority. Jesus speaks the parable of the wicked tenants, which is a parable spoken against the chief priests and the scribes and the Jewish leaders of the people. And then they challenge him on paying taxes to Caesar, which will come up in our text study today. And then Jesus tells his disciples in the hearing of the crowd to beware of the scribes. And so all these events and teachings up to this point through 20 and 21 and 22 become very pointed and adversarial. And then chapter 22 begins the plot to kill Jesus. And there we have the institution of the Lord's Supper, the foretelling of Peter's denial, Jesus' betrayal by Judas, and Jesus being brought before the council. And after the trial before the Jewish council, that brings us to chapter 23 and the trial before Pontius Pilate.
All right, let's take a look at what we're studying today. Luke chapter 23, verses 1 through 25. We're studying with Pastor Jacob Bobby from First Trinity Lutheran Church in Bloomfield, Nebraska. If you have a question or a comment today, the listener lines are open, 314-821-0850 or 1-800-730-2727, 1-800-730-2727. The email address, kfuo@kfuo.org. Let's take a look. Luke chapter 23, verse 1. Then the whole company of them arose and brought him before Pilate. And they began to accuse him, saying, "We found this man misleading our nation and forbidding us to give tribute to Caesar, and saying that he himself is Christ, a king." And Pilate asked him, "Are you king of the Jews?" And he answered him, "You have said so." Then Pilate said to the chief priests and the crowds, "I find no guilt in this man." But they were urgent, saying, "He stirs up the people, teaching throughout all Judea, from Galilee even to this place." So the whole company of them arose and brought him before Pilate and began to accuse him, saying, "We found this man misleading our nation and forbidding us to give tribute to Caesar, saying that he himself is Christ, a king." Pastor?
Yes. Yeah, they bring him before Pilate. Pilate sort of just happens to be in Jerusalem during this time because of the Passover festival. He usually was in Caesarea, which was the seat of sort of that province. And Pilate was mainly there as a military presence because of all the folks coming to Jerusalem for the Passover celebration. But beyond military stuff, sometimes they were responsible for other things, and they were sort of part of the Roman bureaucracy. Pilate himself is a figure we don't know a ton about, but we do have some historical description of his character and of some of the sort of tussles he got into with the Jewish leadership in Jerusalem. He was not very good at respecting the traditions and beliefs of the Jews, and was a couple times not brought up on charges, but reprimanded by Emperor Tiberius for desecrating Jewish traditions and making the people generally mad at him, especially the Jews. And so Pilate is there, and the Jews bring Jesus before Pilate and bring a few charges against Jesus. One is misleading the nation. The other is forbidding to give tribute to Caesar. And the final one is saying that he himself is a king.
And Pilate asked him, "Are you king of the Jews?" And he answered him, "You have said so." What a response from Jesus.
Yeah, this response is people have spilled a lot of ink writing about what this response means. Yeah, it's the charge itself could be in reference, you know, to the Palm Sunday event that happened, you know, in Luke 19, where he comes in and the people proclaim him as king and his disciples do. This is also the question before Jesus at the trial before the council of chief priests and scribes. Jesus's words are not really a direct affirmation, yet they are not in denial. I guess probably the best way to understand Jesus's words is as a sort of a grudging admission, with kind of the suggestion that maybe he would put it otherwise, or that the person asking the question doesn't really understand what they're asking. Jesus is indeed a king, but he is not a king of this world, or his kingdom is not of this world. But the Jews, in claiming that Jesus was a king, was hoping that Pilate would deal with him as someone who desires to incite sedition. The historian Josephus reports that people, trying to stir up sedition and revolt, oftentimes they would find a leader and make him a king, and Pilate would sort of deal with that. And hopefully the Jews are hoping that Pilate will deal with it in the same way with Jesus. And so they say he calls himself a king. Pilate asks him, and Jesus affirms it.
Then Pilate said to the chief priests and the crowds, "I find no guilt in this man." But they were urgent, saying, "He stirs up the people, teaching throughout all Judea from Galilee even to this place."
Right, yeah. Jesus and Pilate here are having an exchange, and the crowd insists that Jesus is indeed stirring up the people and teaching all over Galilee, even to this place. I think the people are hoping that the more urgent call would move Pilate to a quicker decision. But instead, it stirs up the possibility in Pilate's mind that Jesus is from Galilee and therefore under the proper jurisdiction of Herod. And so it kind of ends up backfiring on them, because it'll draw out the process. And here's a good example of the Roman bureaucracy sort of at work. That's not my problem. I'm going to send him someplace else.
Before we go on to Herod, anything else about Jesus before Pilate?
Well, just to point out that Jesus, Pilate here is I mean, it's clear that the political charges against Jesus and his followers are sort of empty charges. If Jesus is a king, he's not a very good one or a very powerful one, and probably doesn't pose that much threat. I mean, the leaders of his own people are bringing him up against charges, and so it's important to point out that it's pretty clear in the text that the political charges are not valid.
All right, so let's go on to the next paragraph, verse 6. When Pilate heard this, he asked whether the man was a Galilean, and when he learned that he belonged to Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him over to Herod, who was himself in Jerusalem at that time. When Herod saw Jesus, he was very glad, for he had long desired to see him because he had heard about him and was hoping to see some sign done by him. So he questioned him at some length, but he made no answer. The chief priests and the scribes stood by vehemently accusing him, and Herod with his soldiers treated him with contempt and mocked him. Then arraying him in splendid clothing, he sent him back to Pilate. And Herod and Pilate became friends with each other that very day, for before this they had been at enmity with each other. So Pilate heard this, asked whether the man was a Galilean. When he learned that he belonged to Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him over to Herod, who was himself in Jerusalem at that time.
Right, right. Herod is there as well. And, you know, Herod is an interesting a figure. Well, his dad, Herod the Great, who was anything but great. This would be one of Herod the Great's children that survived because Herod the Great had executed a number of his children. He was insane by many accounts and jealous and paranoid. But Herod Antipas was the tetrarch and ruler of the principality. Tetrarch is sort of a title for a petty dynasty that was the Romans allowed to exist to allow the people to have some sense of sovereignty or independence from Rome, and so that was Herod's job to rule in Galilee, sort of underneath the Romans. Herod is probably most known in the scriptures for his run-in with John the Baptist. Herod had divorced his wife, married the former wife of his half-brother. This marriage offended his father-in-law and alienated his Jewish subjects, and John the Baptist reproached Herod for the marriage. And so that's the story of Herod and Herodias, and Herodias and Salome, and Salome calling for the head of John the Baptist. Herod's also mentioned at a point in Luke 13 where some folks come to Jesus and the Pharisees do, and they say, get away from here, for Herod wants to kill you. And Jesus responds with, go tell that fox, behold, I cast out demons and perform cures today and tomorrow, and the third day I finish my course. And so Herod's a figure who is intrigued by Jesus and is reported to want to kill Jesus. But here Luke is keen to tell us that he wants to see Jesus because he's heard about him and he wants some sign. And this falls right into line with what Jesus says elsewhere in the Gospels about the scribes and Pharisees desiring signs. Paul talks about in 1 Corinthians, Jews demand signs, Greeks seek wisdom. And so Herod seeks a sign, not it really as proof that Jesus is from God, but probably seeking some spectacle of some sort, and something that will confirm what people have said or at least entertain him.
When Herod saw Jesus, he was very glad. He had long desired to see him because he had heard about him and was hoping to see some sign done by him. So he questioned him at some length, but he made no answer.
Yeah, this particular section of the reading is oftentimes connected to Isaiah 53 and the description of the suffering servant there. That reads Isaiah 53:7. He was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth, like a lamb that is led to slaughter and like a sheep that is before its shearers is silent, so he opened not his mouth. And so oftentimes this is seen as fulfillment of that prophecy that Jesus here is the suffering servant who is silent like the lamb before the slaughter. At the same time, Jesus does, in this section of reading, does answer when honest questions are put before him. But we can probably assume that there wasn't an honest question or anything of value from what Herod discussed with him.
The chief priests and the scribes stood by, vehemently accusing him, and Herod with his soldiers treated him with contempt and mocked him. Then, arraying him in splendid clothing, he sent him back to Pilate, and Herod and Pilate became friends with each other that very day. For before this, they had been at enmity with each other.
Yeah, so Herod doesn't, I mean, you would think that if you found a person innocent, there would be, that would be it. But Herod must take after his father in some sort of a way, and after Jesus is interrogated, he's also mocked and arrayed in splendid clothing, and then he sends him right back to Pilate, and Pilate and him become friends because earlier they were at enmity with each other. The cause of the enmity between Pilate and Herod isn't really known. There's a few possibilities. It could be a reference to Luke 13:1, which is where there's mentioned by the disciples that there were some there's some present with this Jesus who told them about the Galileans whose blood Pilate had mingled with their sacrifices. This is one of the events that the disciples and the people try to put forward to Jesus to say that they were must have been worse sinners than others to receive this sort of punishment. So there's this event, and we don't really know much about it, but at some point, Pilate, most likely during a Passover celebration, probably went into the temple and in order to apprehend and or kill some people that were riling up in revolution. And he ended up killing them in the temple, and their blood mixed with the blood of the sacrifices for the Passover. And this could be the very thing that created enmity between him and Herod, even though the folks, the Jews, didn't really like Herod. At the same time, he may have sided with the Jews in this particular case. And there are a number of other cases that are recorded elsewhere of Pilate doing things that would have made the people upset. He didn't really... at one time, he tried to set up gold-coated shields in honor of Tiberius in Herod's palace. And the people got so upset that they eventually wrote to Tiberius, and Tiberius reprimands Pilate and tells him to cut it out and sort of rebukes him for not taking into account the people's understanding of images and things of that nature. And so there's a variety of things that could have created enmity between Pilate and Herod. But at any rate, that enmity is removed. Pilate sending Jesus to Herod is sort of an olive branch and an affirmation of his authority in his area. And so they're friends after this, at least on better terms than they were before.
We're studying the Daily Lectionary with Pastor Jacob Bobby at First Trinity Lutheran Church in Bloomfield, Nebraska. We're in Luke chapter 23 today. If you have a question or a comment, the phone number is 314-821-0850 or 1-800-730-2727. The email address, kfuo@kfuo.org. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back from that break, we'll continue our study in Luke chapter 23. You're listening to His Time on Worldwide KFUO.
Liturgical art is a beautiful expression of Christ's great love for us. I'm Kelly Schumacher, founder of Agnus Dei Arts, and I would like to help you learn about liturgical art and the beauty it portrays as you view it through paintings, drawings, sculptures, and altarpieces. I'm available to speak with your group. My website is agnusdeiarts.com, agnusdeiarts.com.
Concordia University, Mequon, Wisconsin, overlooks the beautiful shoreline of Lake Michigan. This serene main campus of CUW is just 15 miles north of Milwaukee, with all its vibrant cultural attractions. At Concordia University, Wisconsin, students living by the motto of inspiration in action can choose from 69 undergraduate majors, 14 master degree programs, and doctorates in pharmacy, physical therapy, and nursing practice. For more information or to take a virtual tour, visit cuw.edu.
You're listening to the Daily Lectionary, underwritten by Lutheran Federal Credit Union. I'm Andy Bates. Thanks for joining me here on His Time as we study this New Testament reading in Luke chapter 23 with Pastor Jacob Bobby from First Trinity Lutheran Church in Bloomfield, Nebraska. Luke chapter 23. Pastor, are we ready to pick up at verse 13?
Sounds good.
Pilate then called together the chief priests and the rulers and the people and said to them, "You brought me this man as one who was misleading the people. And after examining him before you, behold, I did not find this man guilty of any of your charges against him. Neither did Herod, for he sent him back to us. Look, nothing deserving death has been done by him. I will therefore punish and release him." So Pilate called together the chief priests and the rulers, said, "You brought me this man, said he was misleading the people. After I've examined him, I don't find anything, him guilty of anything deserving death, at least."
Yeah. Pilate's, it's clear here. I mean, Luke makes it very clear. Pilate sees no reason, for Jesus to be handed over for anything, much less death. And here especially, you know, Pilate reassembles the chief priests and the rulers and the people. The people are elsewhere in Luke pretty friendly to Jesus. And so it's possible here that Pilate has them assembled as witnesses to Pilate's statement of Jesus' innocence. But it's also possible here that the people, you know, as this group is assembled over this time period of the trial, that is also that Luke wants to underline the claim that they are also responsible for Jesus' death, not just the leaders, but the general population. And Pilate's trying to take the heat out of the situation. You know, he's using standard kind of legal phraseology that resembles what we hear of even in the trial of Paul in Acts. And he's putting his own opinion up with Herod's. Whether he knows it or not, he's sort of going by the... he probably doesn't know it, but he's going by the Jewish Old Testament idea of having two witnesses. You can't just put somebody to death with one witness, and so he has two witnesses. And so he found him innocent, Herod's found him innocent. And so it's kind of strange that Pilate would punish and release him having found him innocent, but I think that here Pilate is trying to appease the Jews to punish Jesus for his nuisance, but at the same time, not give him up to crucifixion to punish him as an alternative to that.
"I will therefore punish him and release him and set him free." Yeah.
And that's his plan. I think he thinks that it'll work too. But that Jews, as we will see, won't have it. So,
but they, verse 18, but they all cried out together, away with this man and release to us Barabbas, a man who had been thrown into prison for an insurrection started in the city and murder. Pilate addressed them once more, desiring to release Jesus, but they kept shouting, crucify, crucify him. A third time he said to them, why, what evil has he done? I have found in him no guilt deserving death. I will therefore punish and release him. But they were urgent, demanding with loud cries that he should be crucified, and their voices prevailed. So Pilate decided that their demand should be granted. He released the man who had been thrown into prison for insurrection and murder, for whom they asked, but he delivered Jesus over to their will. So they cried out together, away with this man, release to us Barabbas.
Right, right. And I think that maybe the first question we probably have in this section is, where's verse 17? I don't know if you noticed that, but it kind of goes from 16 to verse 18. If anybody's looking at home on their King James,
you're right.
On their King James version, they have a 17. In Lutheran Study Bible, it tells you why, that in some manuscripts there is a verse 17, and some there is not. In fact, the oldest manuscripts of the scriptures for Luke, there is not a verse 17. And it's thought that verse 17 was sort of added as just an explanation, because what verse 17, if you're in the King James version, reads is, for of necessity he must release one unto them at the feast. So it kind of sets up and explains why in verse 18 the people are calling for Barabbas. So it's just a little explanation note, a marginal note, that's not a part of the original text. And so we skip right over it in the ESV if you're following along with that. But yeah, there was this tradition or precedence of releasing a prisoner during the Passover festival. And whereas Pilate thinks that he'll be releasing Jesus and that will fulfill it. I mean, he's innocent by his accounts. The people do not want that. They want Jesus taken away and crucified. And Barabbas. Barabbas is not a character we know a whole lot about. I know that there's historical fictions written about Barabbas and things like that, but what we know about him is basically what Luke tells us. You know, he's a leader of an uprising and revolt in Jerusalem. There's no really record of this particular riot in Jerusalem that we know of. May have been too trivial to merit in any history book or historical account. But it's pretty clear why he's imprisoned. I mean, he's trying to overthrow the Romans, and in doing that, he murdered either one person or a number of people. We don't really know. But he kind of, if you haven't thought that this account of Jesus's trial has been unjust up to this point, well, now you really have to acknowledge the injustice of the situation. And here you have Jesus, an innocent man, by both Herod and Pilate's accounts, being handed over to the people, whereas Barabbas, who deserves to be where he's at, is released.
So they cried out, away with this man, give us Barabbas, a man who had been thrown into prison for insurrection started in the city and murder. So, I mean, it was nothing, just, these were pretty serious crimes that he'd been arrested for.
This would be like, these are not, he wasn't jaywalking or even, you know, in some petty, you know, even the thief on the cross, I mean, we hear about the thieves on the cross, and we think, "Geez, you know, that for theft." But this was what would be considered even a worse crime than stealing somebody else's property, taking someone else's life. Yeah, so this is a big time sort of a bad guy. And of course, in the eyes of the Jews, they wouldn't have considered him probably less of a bad guy, because if his murder was against the Romans and his insurrection was against the Romans, then most Jews were at least friendly to the idea that the Romans shouldn't be ruling over them and are sort of oppressing them.
Pilate addressed them once more, desiring to release Jesus, but they kept shouting, "Crucify, crucify him." And a third time he said to them, "Why, what evil has he done? I found in him no guilt deserving death. I will therefore punish and release him."
Yeah, you know, Pilate tries for a third time to establish Jesus' innocence, and for the reader of the text, Jesus' innocence couldn't be more firmly underlined than this third attempt of Pilate to sort of take the heat out of the situation and put forth that Jesus is indeed innocent. But Pilate decides at some point that the will of the people should be granted. He sort of gives in. People have called Pilate the coward of history for this very reason, that he gives in to the powers of the people, the powers of darkness that have prevailed. And the church, most people, you know, don't realize this right away when we think about it, but the church emphasizes sort of the culpability of Pilate in the Apostles and Nicene Creed. I mean, if you confess the Apostles and Nicene Creed, you confess that he suffered under Pontius Pilate, that he was crucified under Pontius Pilate in the Nicene Creed. And so this culpability of Pilate in his weakness in giving in to the people and handing an innocent man over to death is sort of a part of our confession of faith, that this is a major part of who we are as Christians, is to recognize this injustice suffered at the hands of Pontius Pilate, and he goes down in history forever as sort of a coward trying to appease the people. You know, in his defense, he has had a number of run-ins with the people and with Emperor Tiberius concerning the people, and so you can see his position in wanting to sort of keep peace, especially, I would say, that because it's the Passover festival and you have a number of Jews descending upon Jerusalem. I mean, the population of the city is way larger than it normally is, and they're all Jews and they're all there for this Passover festival, and so that adds to the power of the people in getting what they demand. And Pilate, you know, gives in.
With just about a minute for this last section here, but they were urgent, demanding with loud cries that he should be crucified, and their voices prevailed. So Pilate decided that their demand should be granted. He released the man who had been thrown into prison for insurrection and murder, for whom they asked, but delivered Jesus over to their will. That last phrase intrigues me, but he delivered Jesus over to their will.
Yeah, the will of the people wins the day, you know, us politically, as Americans, we have a very special place for the will of the people in our government. And here's a glaring example in history where the will of the people is granted and the will of the people is wrong. And I think it does more than point that out. It also kind of convicts all people, you know. The will of the people here is not only wrong, but in a larger sense, the will of the people, made up of individual sinners, is slanted and turned in on themselves, and imperfect, infallible, and fundamentally sinful. And so, here it not only kind of casts a light on the people gathered that day who demanded Jesus' crucifixion, but it also casts a light and convicts even us nowadays who are part of the same group in a way, maybe not historically, but definitely in essence. We are the same people. People are people. Folks are folks, and the will of the people here has its way, and it's wrong. And it crucified, and the will of the people crucifies our Lord.
Looking over the text as a whole, just about 30 seconds to wrap up everything, Pastor. Your final thoughts on our text today as we conclude our study?
Yeah, well, my thoughts on the text are sort of laid out in the sermonette that I gave, and I think here the injustice of the situation is what comes forward when you read it. The whole trial is a sham. The innocence of Jesus is clear, and yet somehow Jesus is the one at the end of the day who's hanging on the cross. And Barabbas is the one who's set free. And I think in this injustice, we cringe at it, and we ought to cringe at it. It's a terrible, terrible thing. At the same time, in this injustice, we see something, we can see ourselves in it, in that, like Barabbas, we are ones deserving of death, deserving of eternal death and hell, and yet Jesus himself takes himself our sins, and because of that we go free. And so it's a very pointed picture of the salvation wrought for us by God through Jesus Christ, and I think that's what you take away when you read it with that lens.
We've been studying the daily New Testament reading with Pastor Jacob Bobby at First Trinity Lutheran Church in Bloomfield, Nebraska. Pastor Bobby, thanks for being our guest and helping us with the daily lectionary today.
Glad to do it. Had a good time. Thank you.
Absolutely. God bless you and all the saints at First Trinity Lutheran Church in Bloomfield, Nebraska. Coming up in just a little bit, Historically Speaking, with our friend Dr. Daniel Harmelink at Concordia Historical Institute. You're listening to His Time on Worldwide KFUO.